from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Detroit is Motor City, the traditional heart of the American automotive industry that sprawls across the center of the country. But California and Silicon Valley are coming on strong in the rising age of driverless cars. Silicon Valley disrupting, again, Google, Uber, Lyft, Apple, reinventing the very idea of the car and how we use it. A new auto industry is emerging on the West Coast. Up next on Point, the future of the American automotive industry. Is it in Detroit or Silicon Valley? You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Are you following how quickly driverless cars are becoming a reality? Where will the heart of the U.S. auto industry be in this country? Silicon Valley? Detroit? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Of course, everybody knows about the long connection between Detroit and cars, but California all over it these days. Here's a TED Talk from March, just a little bit. This is Chris Urmson, head of self-driving cars project at Google, saying driverless cars will correct for the least reliable part of the car, the person behind the wheel.
For the last 130 years, we've been working around that least reliable part of the car, the driver. We've made the car stronger. We've added seatbelts, we've added airbags. And over the last kind of decade, we've actually started trying to make the car smarter to fix that bug, the driver.
That bug, the driver, you and me, and they're way down that path. Driverless cars, easy to see, driving around Silicon Valley these days. Google cars, by and large. Testing, testing, testing. Does Michigan want in on it? Does Detroit want in on it? You better believe they do. Yesterday, U.S. Senator Gary Peters, Democrat, Michigan, talked at the opening of M-City. This is a new testing ground for autonomous vehicle technology in Ann Arbor.
This is the center of the universe. It is Michigan. It's not California. We are not going to let Silicon Valley take this technology, because this technology is born at the University of Michigan, born in the greater Detroit area, and we're going to be the global leader of this technology that will transform mobility.
All right, cars are changing. Where will the heart of the industry be? Joining me now from the Automated Vehicle Symposium in Ypsilanti, Michigan, is Michael Ramsey. He covers the automotive industry for the Wall Street Journal. Michael Ramsey, welcome to On Point.
Great to be here, Tom.
And with us from St. Louis is Bloomberg Businessweek technology writer Ashley Vance. He covers technology from Silicon Valley. He's author of Elon Musk, Tesla, SpaceX, and the Quest for a Fantastic Future. Ashley Vance, welcome to you.
Thanks for having me.
Ashley, let's go to Silicon Valley first. Yesterday was the big day for rolling out the test city for driving in Michigan, but give us a sense of the range and depth of the kind of onslaught in Silicon Valley on this driverless car future. Who's playing? What are they up to?
Yeah, I thought it was a little bit funny to see this kind of test track opening up, and it's an obvious response. I mean, I live in Mountain View, just down the road from Google, and every day I see 20 and upwards driverless cars going around. Google has been sort of the dominant company that so far they're testing cars all the time. We know that Tesla Motors, they've already got sort of an autopilot technology, and Elon Musk is talking about he wants to get to driverless cars in 3 years. Uber just made an agreement with Carnegie Mellon, which is a big autonomous car powerhouse, to develop their own cars. And then there's a handful of startups, and it sounds like Apple is going to get into this too.
So is the sense that Silicon Valley will just develop software packages and ship them to Detroit, or that they might actually produce whole vehicles in California?
It's a mix. I mean, if you look at Tesla, they build their cars today in Silicon Valley at a factory in Fremont, and would completely be determined to sort of own the entire package. They take great pride in their software. They take great pride in their manufacturing. It looks like, you know, Uber has said, the CEO of Uber has said, look, if Tesla could produce 300,000 autonomous cars tomorrow, we would buy every single one of them. And Uber would then sort of just let this fleet go out in the world and have its app kind of controlling them. And then, you know, it sounded like Google, they've made a test car, a fully autonomous car, and they've shown sort of a prototype of it and talked about it coming in 2020. But it sounds like outside of Tesla, most of these companies would sort of look for a manufacturing partner.
Michael Ramsey, how is Detroit looking at the California advance on the driverless car future and Detroit's role in that future?
What I would say is that I think that most automakers are probably less concerned about Apple and Google building cars to compete with them than they are about how humans may use the automobile differently in the future. So if Uber or Lyft is successful and they utilize more of a car-sharing philosophy and fewer people buy cars or they share vehicles and therefore there's less need to buy new cars, I think that they consider that more of an existential threat than if Apple or Google start building their own cars.
You mean I might not own a car at all, just snap my fingers when I need a ride and an Uber pod shows up, no driver, and zips me away?
Yes. I mean, it really, there have been various automakers, especially the Germans and also Ford Motor Company, talk about the, I guess, the disruption on the horizon in a more significant way and are trying to figure out how to adjust their technology to make way for this car sharing that may be our future. You know, I think that people like Ford Motor Company's chairman, Bill Ford Jr., have been more specific about not wanting to cede the technology specifically to Silicon Valley. They've said, he's been public in saying, we don't want to become a handset manufacturer where the, you know, all the good stuff is in the software and we're just, you know, bending metal and doing the expensive and low margin work.
So they're setting up, many of them, research centers in Silicon Valley. I'm looking at a map here. Mike, I think you've been out and looked around a bit, but it looks like every auto manufacturer I can think of has something going on. Here's Volkswagen and BMW, Hyundai and General Motors and Ford and Tesla all around Palo Alto, Mountain View, Sunnyvale, Santa Clara, San Jose, Mercedes-Benz, Toyota. They're all woven right in through that terrain of Apple and Google and all the rest these days, Mike.
Absolutely. It's interesting because they have, about a decade ago, maybe a little bit more, they started, primarily the German automakers and then followed shortly by the Japanese and American automakers, started putting out research centers there. They were small at first. Now some of them have, you know, well over 100 people, and this is where a lot of the advanced driverless vehicle technology is developed, software development for in-car entertainment. And it's also a great spot to recruit because it might be difficult to get some of these bright minds that are on the West Coast and in that environment to come to Michigan, you know, to come to Detroit. And, you know, this is a spot where they can get those people. And also it's, you know, unfortunately for the automakers, it's a good spot for them to train people and then have them picked off by Tesla, Google, and Apple. You're starting to see that a bit more out there as well.
Actually, we heard a lot of chest thumping in Michigan yesterday as this new test track, Test City, they're calling it, opened up with all kinds of features to test driverless or automated automobiles.
Yeah.
Are you so confident that Detroit can play and win in this era, not be reduced, as the Ford Air says, to a handset manufacturer, just doing the hardware while the, you know, value add goes to software?
Well, you know, I mean, I think I was more skeptical a few years ago when, you know, the early days of the driverless car technology, I mean, it looked pretty rough. In 2005, we had this DARPA Grand Challenge where we really saw the first test of these kinds of vehicles, and they only went a few miles, and it was sort of embarrassing. But over time, the technology has improved quite rapidly, especially within, I'd say, kind of like the last 3 or 4 years. And to me, you know, Detroit has really started to fall behind rather quickly. We've seen them do university tests. And then, like I mentioned, I mean, Google has driven hundreds of thousands, if not millions of miles on the open road. I mean, the Google cars are not on a test track. They are right beside you at the stoplight. They're next to you on the freeway. And to me, Detroit had not been taking drastic enough steps to kind of address this stuff. On the other hand, of course, Silicon Valley always oversells just about everything and how far along they are. And so, you know, you've got them out touting how far they are. I've seen the cars myself sort of still have issues. So there's certainly time for Detroit to catch up. It's encouraging to see them take this sort of step. But, you know, I mean, Stanford has kind of morphed into the reason all those companies are in Palo Alto, like you mentioned, is because of the computer scientists coming out of Stanford, and Detroit certainly needs to compete against that.
Full disclosure, my son works for Apple, but he like you, he says, it seems like every time you look over your shoulder out that way these days, Cupertino beyond, you see a driverless car zipping by. What's the Detroit sense of this, Michael, that they can play and win? That was certainly the attitude as the new test facility opened up this week.
I think that you know, I want to make a point distinction. I know that we're talking about Detroit as the region versus Silicon Valley,
yes.
But all the automakers, let's just lump them into Detroit. You know, Toyota, BMW, Mercedes-Benz, Volkswagen, General Motors, Ford, Honda, all of them are versus Silicon Valley. But so when we say Detroit versus mm-hmm. Silicon Valley, it's all existing automakers, except for maybe Tesla versus Silicon Valley. But I would say that the automakers are much more cautious. They are looking at the road to automated vehicles in a step-level function. They want to add assistance features that make you more safe. They're very cautious about what tort liability they might have. I'm at this conference now. A lot of the discussions are about the legal path to autonomous vehicles. Who is going to be held responsibility in, you know, who's held responsible if an autonomous vehicle is involved in an accident? How do autonomous vehicles act in the environment with humans who break the law? You know, there are all these questions. So the automakers, I feel like they have the capability, but what they don't have that companies like Google and Tesla have been shown to do is the willingness to really push the boundary of what is legal or ethical today. So I think that is one of the issues that may be holding them back.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about where the heart of the American automotive industry will be, Detroit or Silicon Valley, as the push for driverless cars gains speed, gets very real. Michael Ramsey covers the automotive industry for the Wall Street Journal with us today from the Automated Vehicle Symposium going on right now in Ypsilanti, Michigan. With us from St. Louis, normally out of Silicon Valley, is Ashley Vance, technology writer at Bloomberg Business Week. Yesterday, there was the M-City track being opened in Ann Arbor. Big credit. It's being called a simulated city for automated vehicles to be taken through the paces. Here's a little sound of that.
Pedestrian coming from the right.
Emergency braking.
Sound of test driving in automated land out of Michigan. University of Michigan teamed up with automakers, tech industry, government agencies to create M-City. Here's Peter Swetman, director of the university's Mobility Transformation Center. This is a promotional video for the new test facility in Michigan.
We believe that this transformation to connected and automated mobility will be a game changer for safety, for efficiency, for energy. Our cities will be much better to live in. Our suburbs will be much better to live in.
Detroit, or Michigan, making the case for automated vehicles. Michael, Ashley, it's interesting, the range of response here coming in online. Neil writes, autonomous cars are a big ooh-ah thing that have very large challenges and minimal benefits. But you've got other listeners going just the other way. Derek writes on Twitter, more free time, less congestion, easier parking, safer, all caps, exclamation mark. The future is now. Let's get going. And then people's imaginations go to work in a hurry. Scott writes, it would seem Florida would be a huge market for self-driving cars with its immense elderly population. Michael, how far along is this? When might we see much higher degrees of autonomy and then straight-up driverless cars on the highway, whether in fleets for Uber or, beyond that, for consumers themselves?
I think that it's very possible that we will see a fully automated car with a steering wheel, maybe not the Google level of steering wheel-free car, that could do most driving tasks for sale by 2020. It's very likely that this car will be a $100,000 Mercedes-Benz and not a car that a standard normal citizen could buy, but I think that that's a realistic timeline. Right now, automakers like Audi are already capable of doing very long, hundreds of miles test drives where the car handles all the tests, and you basically press two buttons on each side of the steering wheel and say, autopilot engaged, and the car drives itself. So the technology is actually not that far off, and most automakers have it. The problem is, like many of these technologies, it's incredibly expensive, and there are some regulatory things that the general automakers have to work out. The other part of this is when would you be able to have in a limited form some sort of service that could pick you up in an urban area, like let's say downtown San Francisco, because it's close to Mountain View where Google is mm-hmm. operating, some sort of fleet that could pick you up and take you from point A to point B in an area where it's mapped very precisely and they've run the routes many times. I really don't think that's that far off. I'm going to say that within 10 years from today, there will be a service like that operating in heavily congested downtown areas, probably going to be San Francisco, or maybe it would be another, you know, German city. This will be in operation in 10 years. Very likely.
Actually, that timetable starts to get very real. 2020 is not even 5 years away now, or just 5 years away. How do you see the timetable Michael's laying out there? Does that look like what you're expecting? What steps along the way are you first anticipating?
I mean, that is what Google's claiming so far. I mean, they're saying 2020 for their car that has no steering wheel. They're, like Michael was alluding to, you know, today, these cars do very, very well, especially on the freeway, and the technology needed to sort of do well on the freeway is less than you would need in a congested city. But there's a whole school of thought that says some of the first cars we could see would be in cities, and it would be, you know, if you're going under 25 miles an hour, that would be kind of the limit. And their cars are very good at avoiding sort of bodily harm and severe collisions at that speed. And so, you know, we might see a scenario where we have those cars intermixed in the city earlier, and they're just kind of limited to 25 miles an hour. There's a startup called Zoox, which we don't know a ton about. It's kind of a stealth startup for the moment, although there's been a couple stories, and they have taken it's one of the leads of Stanford's autonomous technology who's gone and started his own company. They have a lot of Stanford's patents. From what I understand, they're trying to get on the road by 2017 and would be, probably sort of the first. They have a car. They've completely rethought the way a traditional car looks. There's no windshield. There's no back window. There's just side windows. They're doing things like putting airbags on the outside of the car instead of inside. And, so these are the kinds of – it can go forward and backward. Just each wheel has its own motor. And so the car can just go forward, backward. It's all the same to it. And so, you know, I think we should also think about completely different ideas of what a car looks like.
And this is not some software package that they'd be sending off to Michigan. This would be completely built in California?
Yeah, well, it's early days for them, to be sure, and they're just kind of at the prototype stage. But, yeah, I mean, they're looking to build a car from scratch. It's obviously once you get to the point where you have to get a manufacturing facility. We saw with Tesla that when Silicon Valley tried to build a car, it was much harder than I think
they assumed.
You know, it took about 10 years for Tesla to make a decent car. So there's big questions there, but yeah, they're actually making hardware. They're inventing the software, but the hardware has been rethought as well.
A startup called Zoox, Zoox. Check it out online. A lot of callers. Then we'll go to Michigan for a University of Michigan report here. Ben in New Orleans. Ben, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. I just my opinion was that we are seeing the dinosaurs dying. We are seeing the beginning of the end. It reminds me of Netflix versus Blockbuster. You know, they're so sure they're on top of the world, and you know, something comes in and surprises them out of the blue, and it's much faster, much more efficient, much sleeker than they are. And I'm excited for it. I'm ready for it to happen.
So you're ready for the driverless car future. I have to say, I'm not sure that they're all that resistant in Detroit. We'll hear from University of Michigan in just a moment, where they've been doing a lot of research pushing the frontier here. Let me get one more call. Charleston, South Carolina. Sam, you're on.
Hi, Tom. I'm interested in this as it applies to those who cannot drive, particularly as silly as it may sound, dogs. they are smart enough to toggle a switch with their nose or their paw. And they're a great first market. The dog could be taken to and from the dog park, no longer having to stare at wall all day, and it reduces the liability during the testing phase.
Sam says, drive my dog to the dog park. I don't know, Sam. I mean, anything's possible here. What about those with limited driving capacity, Michael? Is that an early market? I don't know about whether it's dogs or humans who may face challenges in mobility that might make this particularly appealing.
This is the most exciting and interesting part of autonomous vehicles, is the ability to make driving possible for those who can't easily drive themselves, the elderly, the infirm, the handicapped, children. The possibilities are huge. This is also one of the reasons why the federal government is extremely supportive of these technologies. Someone mentioned before the state of Florida. State of Florida is one of the states that has the most interest in autonomous vehicle technology because of their elderly population and the possibility of increasing mobility. I'm hoping that Ryan actually will talk to you a bit about what they're working on, but one of the real interesting conundrums that occurs with the idea of having people picked up is how the car will know that you're the right person to pick up. When it comes to you, I mean...
Of course. Anybody could jump in and take it for a spin. That's interesting in itself. Michael, hold the thought. Let's go right to Ryan Eustace, joining us now from Ann Arbor in Michigan, professor in the College of Engineering at University of Michigan, runs the University of Michigan Perceptual Robotics Laboratory, and has been on the design committee for M-City, this new automated test facility for automated vehicles that just opened this week outside of Ann Arbor. Ryan Eustace, thank you very much for being with us today.
Hi, Tom.
So are you guys on the cutting edge? Are you the cutting edge?
Yeah, we're definitely very much on the cutting edge. I think this new facility, M-City, that we're talking about this week that just opened, you know, it's part of a mixed strategy of helping to really bring this technology to market. And so it augments our ability to do testing on public roadways, like we've been talking about on the show. Other entities are doing that. But the unique feature of M-City is it's really this mock urban environment that allows us to do the way that I like to think about it allows us to be maximally evil to the technology within M-City.
What do you mean, Ryan?
Well, so this has a mock urban environment. So it has like fake building facades that actually block the field of view for the sensors that we're talking about on these cars, like the cameras and the radars and the LIDARs that help the car to sense the environment around it. It has intersections with stoplights, just like you'd find in any normal city. And we can actually write software for these stoplights to make them change from green to red at the absolutely wrong time and create hard braking events, while at the same time a mechanized pedestrian can basically step out into the roadway. And so we can basically put the car through these kind of corner cases, you know, these very challenging conditions that when you drive on public roadways, you do encounter them, but you encounter them kind of few and far between.
I heard you say cameras and radars and LIDARs.
The LIDARs are basically lasers. So basically using pulses of light that from these sensors that basically allow you to measure the range to objects in the environment. So with a sensor like a LIDAR, you can get millions of data points per second. And so some of the challenge there is how you take that raw data and use computers and algorithms to basically turn that into a high-level representation, much like you or I as a human, able to make, you know, human-level driving decisions.
Your goal, as I see it here, is to give these automated vehicles human-level decision-making capacity. That sounds like a very tall order. How's it going?
Very tall. Yeah, no, technology, I think, is at a point, you know, where we can see deployments of these vehicles. I mean, you know, Google is very public about the miles driven and having fleets of vehicles running around in Mountain View in the area. I think some of the big challenges for us in being able to achieve these kind of human level scenarios will be issues like, say, like weather. So, for instance, you know, if you've ever driven in the Northeast or in a snowy area of the country, you'll know that
when
it snows,
yeah.
Yeah, when it snows, I mean, do you drive in what you know to be the lane of your road, you know, or do you drive in the tire tracks of the guy in front of you?
Yeah. That all depends on what else is going on.
Exactly. So it all depends on what's going on. So it's that kind of that top-down reason of being able to understand the situation and kind of make those human level kind of understanding of the environment and dealing with those corner cases, that's where a lot of the challenge, I think, lies in really deploying this technology nationwide, all weather.
Ryan Eustace is right in the heart of it at University of Michigan. Pardon me, Ryan, but I've got a caller maybe for you here. Milwaukee, John is calling. John, you're on the air with Ryan Eustace.
Yeah, hi, how's it going? I just wanted to kind of say, you know, this is where we're going. Our country has always chosen technology as a major point where we're going to move forward. We're going to push the envelope. And I think as a nation, the fact that we're even talking about this right now shows that this is where we're going. And if you look to the past, Silicon Valley has been the forefront of technology. So this is, it's going to be the center of at least the software development. And I think that if Detroit wants to keep their hat in that, they're going to at least need to try and find some kind of partnership, some kind of way to co-mingle with what's going on there, because they've established themselves as the technological forefront. And it's going to be really, really hard to try and match them. And as an industry, I think it would just be a much better idea for them to try and, try and just like work with these people, because they are clearly, based on everything we've seen, they are at the forefront of it.
Yeah, John, we've got it. Out of Milwaukee, let me put it to our good man in Ann Arbor. Ryan, what about, how do you see the division of labor, if that's the right way to put it, between Detroit, the traditional auto industry, and the Silicon Valley newcomers? How do you see that evolving, Ryan?
Well, I think there's a lot of activity going, you know, like we said, across the country, both Silicon Valley and in Detroit. So one of the big projects that I have is actually in collaboration with Ford Motor Company, where we're working on full-scale self-driving vehicles. And actually, Ford's been in this game for a long time. They actually were back in the DARPA Grand Challenge series of events that the U.S. government had put on, you know, back in the late 2000s.
Yeah.
We've actually been working with Ford in this technology since 2006 or so. I think from Ford's perspective, they are trying to tap into the good work that's being done, you know, across the country. So they have a research center in Palo Alto. They have one here in Ann Arbor. They have one in Boston with MIT. They have one in Germany with the University of Aachen. Mm-hmm. So I think Ford is trying to tap into all the different pools of expertise to really help bring this technology to market.
What if the very idea of the car changes? Will that work for what we call Detroit, Ryan? If we don't own cars that we drive, but rather sort of snap our fingers or hit an app and transportation shows up, does that work for Detroit?
Very much so. I mean, I think in all the conversations I've had with Ford Motor Company, I mean, Ford views themselves as a mobility company, right? They want to provide mobility, how you transport yourself from destination A to B. And so I think they want to provide that as a service. So I think Ford's very much forward-thinking, and they don't want to be a dinosaur. They want to very much be around for the next 100 years or more.
So what's the timetable? Is it a step function where you are? Are we going to see more and more autonomy built into cars as we know them in the years right in front of us?
I wish I had a crystal ball to really be able to forecast that accurately. I think it's going to be a mix of both. I mean, there's definitely two different kind of roadmaps. There's the step function approach, which is very much what Google's going for, to basically just have this advanced capability for the car to drive itself. A lot of the technology that goes into making that happen also has a lot of utility in terms of more driver assistance-like systems, so like active safety systems to help the car understand that the humans may be making a wrong control action, and the car can intervene to help prevent an accident from happening. And that alone could have a huge impact on, if we're talking about the number of deaths annually, which right now is about 33,000 deaths annually.
Yeah.
And to put that in perspective, that's like a Boeing 777 airplane falling out of the sky every 3 days.
So when you think about it like that.
It's like, wow, how can we have a transportation network that seems so unreliable, right?
Ryan Eustace at the University of Michigan College of Engineering, thank you so much for being with us. Good luck there. Michael Ramsey, Ashley Vance, stand by. We're talking the future of the American automotive industry and driverless cars. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at WBUR.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes. Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour about where the heart of the American automotive industry will be, Detroit or Silicon Valley or some mixture, as the push for driverless cars gains speed. Gets very real. Ashley Vance is with us, technology writer for Bloomberg Businessweek, covers Silicon Valley, author of Elon Musk, Tesla, SpaceX, and the Quest for a Fantastic Future. Driverless cars very much envisioned by lots of players these days as part of that future. Michael Ramsey is with us from Ypsilanti, Michigan today. He's at the Automated Vehicle Symposium going on there right now. Automotive reporter for the Wall Street Journal. Lots of response online. You know, many people saying, bring it on. There's a lot of things I would do while I drive. But Bridget says, America loves to drive. We love road trips, wind in our hair, music on the radio, wheel in hand. And certainly there has been a long tradition of that as well. Many issues get raised here. Austin, Texas, Phil is calling. Hi, Phil, you're on the air.
Hi. I thought Tom's the Hot Rod Magazine. Basically, one of the questions that we've been thinking about is liability in the case of an accident. Do you place liability, like in a two-vehicle accident, on the driver, on the vehicle, or in the case of a single-vehicle accident, if the decision by the vehicle was what caused the accident? Where do we find liability in that?
Phil, let us pick it up. Out of Austin, Michael Ramsey, you're at the Autonomous Conference there. What's the conversation around liability? Is everyone soon going to hop out of their car once they have a fender bender and say, not me, the car did it?
Oh, there's a lot. It might be the most interesting issue around autonomous vehicles. Certainly, it's the one that gets discussed the most. Basically, there are a couple schools of thought. If you believe that the number of accidents are going to drop significantly because the computer's sensors on board are going to prevent them, some insurers are saying we may just move to a no-fault situation, where it would be not the same as, where there's a clear, I am the person who caused this accident, I'm responsible, that the insurance company would say, no, there's no fault in the situation because it was unavoidable. The computer is so much better driver than humans that we'll go to that situation. There are some believe that automakers themselves may take on more liability. It's likely that that could happen in more of a legal framework, civil litigation. So, mm-hmm. That's the discussion line, is that if we believe that accidents and deaths may drop by 80%, is there really a much point in pursuing who's responsible from an insurance angle?
And is that the expectation, that we humans are so much more careless or less observant than computers, and we could have an 80% reduction in accidents?
Some people think it's higher, actually. I mean, there is already evidence in the very limited number of cars on the road that have collision avoidance technology built in, so they automatically brake when the driver's not can't brake fast enough. They can sense the car in front of them slowing down, and it will brake for you. That in systems like that, Volvo's had them on the road in limited fashion since 2006, and then more recently, more advanced systems, that accidents with people who have those systems are 30% lower. And that's not even the full suite of technology that's available now. But 30% reduction in those, that's dramatic. And then it could drop even more. In a lot of times, there are accidents that are caused by someone else that you just can't avoid. No matter what, and the significance of those accidents are much less. So, therefore, there's fewer injuries, and the damage caused in the accidents is lower.
It's pretty amazing, getting everybody's attention here, including the insurance industry. I think I read, perhaps in your story, Michael, that State Farm Insurance is one of those who's been involved with setting up this test track in the new one in Michigan.
That's right. The insurance industry is incredibly interested in this. It's almost an existential issue for them as well. If the number of accidents drops dramatically, do you need as many insurance companies? Will they make as much money? Can they continue charging the same premiums? It is a big question for them, and they are intensely interested in it.
It's kind of mind-blowing on lots of fronts here. Bill in Lincoln, Illinois. Bill, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
And I love your radio show. Listen for years.
Great.
I've been turning wrenches on cars since I was 17 years old.
Good you.
You know, I'm a mechanic, and we've all gotten the blue screen of death on our computer at one point. What's the reliability of these things? What if one of these laser sensors goes defunct? Do I need a $1,000, $2,000 software download and a bunch of new parts put in this thing? You know, what's the expense of this once the warranty expires?
Reliability and expense. Let us pick it up, Bill, and I'm glad you're listening, and I appreciate your call. Glad to have a good mechanic out there listening in. Actually, let me bring that to you. I mean, Tesla is already doing software updates over the internet for its vehicles, but what about reliability over time? Of course, there's reliability issues with traditional automobiles, but if the whole thing just shuts down, that could be scary. And what about the relative expense of repairs in this software-driven future?
Yeah, well, you know, the blue screen of death comment is apt. I mean, I think even just a few years ago, none of us would feel safe getting into these cars knowing kind of the state of our computers. But, you know, computing has improved dramatically. The consumer electronics have improved dramatically over the last few years as well. The truth is it would be very expensive to repair today. The LiDAR, all these systems that go onto these cars is very costly. Like Michael was saying, I mean, you know, if the first one comes out and it's a $100,000 Tesla or Mercedes, it's going to be expensive to repair. I think the future we're going to, though, is you know, much brighter than today. You mentioned Tesla. I mean, you go to bed at night and you have maybe you have a problem in your car and it gets fixed while you're asleep, or they even add new features to your car. There's a new kind of traction control. It charges faster than it did the day before, and so it's an exciting time when our cars, instead of the moment you buy it and drive it away from the dealership, it's just kind of degrading. Now our cars can get upgraded and we can get new features. And so, you know, I think there's trade-offs, but to me, the opportunities are really exciting.
Our mechanic in Illinois watching those trade-offs very, very carefully, thinking about an economic future as well as an automotive mobility future here. I want to go to Washington for a moment. And Mark Moreau, he's Senior Fellow Policy Director at the Metropolitan Policy Program at Brookings Institute, studies the geography of advanced industries. Mark, thanks very much for being with us today. Good to be with you, sir.
Hey, Tom. How are you?
It's been a long time. And here you are on top of this one. Where's the talent? Where's the future when it comes to automated vehicles, Mark?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is and both conversation, actually. There's no doubt that this is the ultimate convergence of technologies, really, of places, of technologies, of legacy technology and new stuff. So clearly, I'd say the tilt is to the production of what's essentially a rolling smartphone on wheels. So clearly, Silicon Valley is going to be all over this. It's a consumer electronics item. Dozens of technologies are coming out of Silicon Valley and will dominate and will change these industries. But Detroit can't be counted out. Decades of R&D under its belt, deep understanding of those foibles of those sadly imperfect drivers, huge installed base, manufacturing capacity in hundreds of dealerships. You can't forget any of that stuff. And then I would say, so Detroit has a lot of tech capacity here. There are 33,000 computer systems designers in Detroit.
Versus how many in Silicon Valley?
Yeah, more, like double that. But Detroit is not, at this point, a complete legacy old economy mm-hmm. machine.
Mm-hmm.
Meanwhile, where are these things going to be built? Are the VC community of California going to have the patience with building $2 billion plants at a pop? So it's obvious to me this is going to be a mashup. It's not either or. You're going to be running a bunch of Silicon Valley technologies through a U.S. manufacturing base that's diffused all over the country from Detroit to Nashville. So I think this is good for America. This is what it feels like when you've got true American competitiveness and true innovation flourishing in the country. Things are confusing. It's going to be a mashup. Ecosystems matter. We've got a great high-tech, deep ecosystem in Silicon Valley, and we've got incredible manufacturing capability in the auto tier. So I think it's going to be both.
Ashley Vance, you cover Silicon Valley. How do they look at the material future of these self-driving cars? Maybe the image we have in mind of several thousand pounds of steel and metal and rubber is the wrong one. If the safety's so much higher, maybe we'll be driving around, you know, bubbles that barely have a material presence. I don't know, just wheels and a bubble on top.
Well, I think that is what you should think about. You know, if you think about sort of like a pizza getting delivered to you, to me, the idea that a car in the future is going to be bringing you a pizza, you know, that's just not realistic. I mean, you'd have this teeny little electric vehicle zipping around delivering food. I mean, there's no reason you should have this massive hunk of metal going around. I think the Silicon Valley has done a pretty, outside of Tesla, a kind of lousy job of thinking through all the mechanics of exactly how these things would be produced. I mean, Silicon Valley's lost a lot of its manufacturing know-how over the last 10 to 15 years, and so we're not as strong there. But, you know, the startup I mentioned, Zoox, they're making a much lighter weight car exactly along that idea. I think I mentioned they're getting rid of the windows that you would even look out going forward. And so I think it would make much more sense to have a lighter weight electric car for this,
so
this type
we,
of scenario.
When we think of automotive manufacturing, it may be something quite different that's being turned out. Jason in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Jason, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi. I'm very glad that one of your earlier guests mentioned the use of mechanical pedestrians on test tracks.
Yeah.
I'm an inveterate bicyclist, an urban bicyclist. I have a car. I use it when I need to carry loads. I'm concerned about, I don't want to share the road with driverless vehicles if they're still aspiring to be as good as humans. I want them to
not
be
good enough, huh?
Much better than humans, because things happen quickly, badly to bicyclists out there. Tom, I'm sure you heard about a story of a 14-year-old girl who was in an accident cycling and texting at the same time had an unfortunate situation. But there's more out there than other cars. And please do your best.
Jason, I'm glad you raised that. Let's hold the biker thought right there, if I may, for a minute. Of course, we're humans in the cars and on the bikes, and we can be unpredictable. So can the roads. Let me get one more right on top of that, if I may, Jason. Lou in Storrs, Connecticut. Lou, you're on.
Hi. I have a question. The first one being, if you're using active sensing, such as the LiDAR or the radar, is there going to be a problem with multiple vehicles interfering with each other's sensors? And second, how are you going to program in the ethics here? For example, if there are three pedestrians in the road and one driver, would the car run over the pedestrians or drive off the road, sacrifice the driver? Will it protect the maximum number of people or the owner?
Ethics and complicated overlapping active sensing going on. I don't know. Michael Ramsey, 5,000 car pileup when all the computer sensors start to bounce off each other. And what about the ethics of these self-driving vehicles?
I don't think that the sensor issue is a concern, but the ethics is a huge concern. It's one of the things that what he mentioned is one of the exact things that gets talked about quite a bit at conferences like the one I'm at is what is the ultimate decision? A lot of times it's one similar, like, do I run over a child or do I hit two adults? You know, or can I, or do I sacrifice the driver, or do I just brake and try to stop the vehicle the best I can, agnostic of who I'm going to eventually run into? Those are questions that I don't know that can be easily solved. Of course, it will be programmed into the computer, but my suspicion is that the way that you handle that is that you try to avoid the accident at all costs, and if not, it just
it doesn't matter who's going to be hit.
Somehow, somewhere, some philosopher, king, ethicist, engineer is going to have to write that algorithm to make a decision. Tom in Youngstown, Ohio. Tom, you're on the air.
Yes, sir. I drive a semi-truck, a heavy truck, and we already use a lot of these systems that you're talking about. There's stability systems which will apply brakes to individual tires to help maintain stability if you're leaning too far in a curve.
Yep.
We also have the adaptive cruise controls which help maintain the safe following distance. A lot of these systems are already in use out there.
And we're glad for that, Tom, but do you worry about your career long-term as more autonomy comes in as a truck driver?
Not really. There's still going to be need for a human touch, so I believe we're still pretty safe there.
Tom, we wish you luck. Mark Miro, the mashup, you say, is coming. Does this help the whole industry stay in the USA? Are we a national leader on the autonomy front or not?
I would say arguably this ferment, this debate we're having right now about whether it's Silicon Valley or Detroit points to the fact that right now the U.S. is killing it globally. I was in Michigan, in Munich this winter, and the folks at BMW and elsewhere are second-guessing themselves and wondering why this ferment is occurring in the U.S., why Tesla has emerged in the U.S. I think this is a great advertisement for U.S. advanced industry prowess, that we're deep, we have an array of technologies we can bring to bear. We have old line manufacturing. We have the newest technologies around. Oh, and by the way, what about Pittsburgh? You know, where Carnegie Mellon's whole robotics team has been commandeered by Uber. So I think it's this is a testimony to U.S. competitiveness.
Not to mention, this should be a way to cut down on fuel consumption and exhaust when it comes to mobility. All that looks like a good thing. Maybe this is a moment to celebrate. We'll see where the center of gravity ends up. Maybe a lot of the country benefiting from this. Mark Murrow at Brookings Institute, the Metropolitan Policy Program there. Thank you so much for being with us today, Mark.
Thanks so much. Take care.
Michael Ramsey, covering automotive for the Wall Street Journal. Michael, you're terrific. Thanks for your reporting and thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And Ashley Vance at Bloomberg Business Week, covering Silicon Valley. Thank you, Ashley.
Thank you.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.